Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome along to the Slacktivist Action Group. We have the referendum coming up for the EU. Boris Johnson has been described as a cut-price Donald Trump. And there are certainly some similarities. Donald Trump married 3 times, Boris married 2x, and has had at least 3 documented affairs. And you're thinking, what are the tabloids waiting for? Paddy Ashdown got known after one affair as Paddy Pantsdown. Surely the papers should be having more fun, given that Boris's surname is Johnson and his initials are BJ. And Boris last week was saying that you couldn't actually buy bunches of bananas thanks to EU regulations in more than bunches of 2 or 3. So loads of people then went on social media with a bunch of 4 bananas, didn't they? Going, fuck you, Boris. And then Boris said, no, I got it wrong. Basically, what I was saying was, you can only buy bunches of more than 2 or 3 bananas. You can't buy bunches of 2 or 3 bananas. At which point, people got their bunches of 4 bananas, ripped them in half, and went, fuck you, Boris. Turns out that you can, in fact, have bunches of bananas of as many as you like. Retailers can sell them. Basically, what the EU regulations say, they say you can have a hand of bananas with as many fingers as you like. Now, I was unaware that a bunch of bananas was known as a hand, or that an individual banana was known as a finger. Certainly, if you went to a fruit and veg shop, saw a banana and said, please, could I have a finger? It's risky, ladies and gentlemen, it's risky. But there have been loads of EU myths, haven't there, over the years about bananas. We had one, didn't we, saying, oh, you've got to ban them because they're all straight. We're going to ban straight bananas. Then another one, we're going to ban curved bananas. Now, where have all these Euro myths come from? Well, most of them seem to have been dreamt up by Boris Johnson himself when he was the Brussels correspondent of the Daily Telegraph. The difference between then and now is that we now have Channel 4 Fact Check, which is essentially somebody following Boris Johnson around and every now and again going, bullshit. But it turns out people do care about the shape of their bananas, don't they? Because you can now buy for £2.41 a banana lunchbox guard holder carrier. A little banana-shaped lunchbox to stop your banana getting squashed on the way to work. Why don't people just buy a larger lunchbox so you can fit a sandwich and a banana into the lunchbox? Because at the moment, if you don't have a banana to take to work, the banana-shaped lunchbox isn't much freaking good unless you cut your sandwich into the shape of a bloody banana. And it turns out the reviews for the Banana Guard lunchbox aren't very good, because it turns out a lot of bananas don't actually fit the Banana Guard lunchbox. So it would be quite useful, though, wouldn't it, to have EU regulations about bananas, because at the moment, if you want something to fit into your banana-shaped lunchbox, you actually have to take your Banana Guard lunchbox down to a fruit and veg shop to work out which bananas actually fit into the lunchbox itself, which probably get you some funny looks from the fruit and veg seller, regardless of whether you've asked for a finger or not. And then when it comes to it, you'll see online, right, this Banana Guard lunchbox comes with an integral fork. Who eats a banana with a fork? Because let's face it, the only reason you'd have a fork is probably to mash the banana, and if you were going to mash the banana, it wouldn't matter if it was a bit squashed in the first place. It is consumerism gone mad, isn't it, ladies and gentlemen? Which is very ugly in the time of austerity. It's like these people who go, oh, look at my diver's watch. Look at my diver's watch. Yeah, it goes down to a depth of 200 metres, this does. 200 metres is the depth of the North Sea. If you find yourself at the bottom of the North Sea, you're not diving, are you? The ship has sunk. The air bubble is running out. And it's little consolation you know what the sodding time is. So with that, would you please welcome to the stage our three guests for today. Would you please welcome Damien Green MP, author and broadcaster, Anita Anand, and comedian, stand-up podcaster, and ambidextrous spin-fast medium bowler, Andy Zaltzman! Andy, would you like to start us off? What are you a bit slack about that you'd, in an ideal world, you'd be less slack about?
Well, I mean, I'd probably do more to create world peace. I think that would be a really good idea. Could benefit the planet as a whole. I probably don't do enough. I try to spread the word of cricket to uncivilised countries like the USA. Most of the world's problems, historically, excluding little ups and downs in the history of the British Empire, have been caused by one or both sides involved not being cricket-playing nations. So, I mean, you extrapolate that, then surely if everyone in the world played high-level test match cricket, we'd live in an eternal utopia.
Apart from the fact that the USA now, it's their fastest-growing sport, isn't it?
Well, yes, I mean...
Technically, I haven't done an awful lot of research into what you're saying, but I'm shooting you down on that particular one.
Fastest growing is a relative thing, isn't it? I mean, we talk here about fastest growing economies. It depends how slow they're going.
But it is massive now, isn't it? Because they've got a massive Indian population, and it's...
Yes.
And you can now play cricket in Central Park on a regular basis, as I understand.
Yes, and the last two times I've been to the States, I've been picked up by a taxi driver at the airport who had a cricket bat in the boot, which in some parts of the world would seem threatening. But, you know, it was quite heartening in New York.
So you'd like to spread cricket to more places?
Absolutely.
Anita, what about you?
Well, apart from... I should really talk a little more about the ups and downs of the colonial era, clearly. But the thing that I'm useless about is appointments and diaries. It's just a nightmare. Not professionally, it seems fine. But I've turned up to a birthday party a month early... and got really affronted when the doorman wouldn't let me in. And just, in fact, on Friday, I had to tweet to say, I've written in my diary, 27th, I am seeing somebody. Is it you? No idea. Yeah.
Did you get lots of offers from Twitter?
I got very strange recommendations. But, I'm hopeless. I write things down. This is very important, don't forget it, but then we'll not say
what
it
is. Did you not also put on Twitter, what should I tell my husband?
Yeah. No, my husband is here, and he thinks I'm the biggest prat in the world. He said, I spoke to him this morning. I said, what shall I say about my Slack thing? And he said, do you really need to ask me? Look at your diary. So, yeah, it is. It's actually, I think it's a condition. I think it's a problem. I
should point out that it's much better to turn up a month early to a birthday party than a month early to a funeral.
Yes.
Sorry, is that hit not been called in yet? My mistake, sorry.
Yeah. I was going to offer being clumsy myself. I fell off a bus recently. Thank you very much for the sympathy from the audience there. But no, it was one of those Route Master buses that were going very slowly, right past where I wanted to get off. Right, so I thought, I'll jump off the back, this will be out. And quite, it wasn't going slowly as I thought it was. So I went arse over tit in front of this bus queue. And they all started laughing. And at that point, a taxi pulled up. And I thought he's going to get out and help me. No. Tooting his horn, make sure I got out of the road. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to front this out. Right? So I got up, I bowed to the taxi queue, I bowed to the bus driver, I bowed to the taxi man, and then I went round the corner and had a little cry. So, Damien, what about you?
It's good to know that physical comedy is not dead in this.
It was unintentional physical comedy, sadly.
Yeah. I wish, this is a sort of professional problem, that you have to be nice to people as a politician. You can all shout at each other and be rude to each other, but to the general public, of course, it's terrible if you're anything other than completely polite. And I wish I would take people on when they say offensive things more. In particular, the next time somebody says to me, I'm not racist, but I would quite like to have the nerve to punch them. I should say, as an ex-police minister, I do not advocate physical violence in any circumstances. That would be a career-defining move, not in a good way. But nevertheless...
It's when they say, I'm not racialist, but...
Yes.
So let's talk about the EU vote, Damien. You're obviously part of your director of the Stronger In campaign. One of the reasons for the referendum was to, in some ways, heal the rift, was it not, over Europe in the Conservative Party.
It's going well.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, it's going particularly well at the moment. Obviously, Boris was there, sort of saying that Obama came over, didn't he, and said, oh, we should stay in the EU. And then Boris said, I'm not racist, but one of the reasons he said that Obama doesn't like Britain was that he was part Kenyan. Whereas, of course, Boris himself, only part British, wasn't he? He was actually born in America, named after a Russian, looks like a Swedish person who's eaten another Swedish person.
And Boris is Turkish, isn't he?
He does have some Turkish ancestry, yes.
But, I mean, the whole point is that, particularly the Leave campaign have said for years that we're not really... like Europeans, we should listen to the Anglosphere. This is a phrase they've created, meaning basically other people who speak English and mostly play cricket, as it happens. You know, our friends are Australia and New Zealand and the United States and Canada and people like that. Hilariously, the leaders of every one of those countries have said, for God's sake, please stay in the EU. So those people who the Leave campaign have said, these are our traditional friends, these are ones we should stick by, have all said, stick with the EU.
Is that because they're terrified of us restarting empire if we leave the EU?
Well,
they don't want us back.
I think we're back to my Nigel Farage thought here, that there are certainly people who, you know, feel that, you know, let's bring back the 19th century. But I think most of the Leave campaign are, you know, just wrong and are a bit confused about Britain's place in the world.
Well, I mean, Boris basically then started talking that, you know, if we stayed in the EU, he compared unifying Europe to Hitler, didn't he? And when you come to Hitler, there's a rule, isn't there? Godwin's law of the internet, which is basically the longer an internet discussion goes on, the chances of somebody mentioning Hitler increases exponentially.
Yeah. So I've even seen Hitler suggested as a solution to England's problem on the left side of midfield as well.
Yeah. it's also an iron law of politics that if you introduce Hitler into a debate, you're losing it.
Well, he's gone early on the Hitler thing, isn't he?
Yeah.
He was losing it on the economy. He's only, oh, well, let's straight go to Hitler.
But, I mean, it was a concentrated Hitlerian period. I mean, there was Ken Livingstone who couldn't stop talking about Hitler.
Because it worked out well for Ken, didn't it?
Obviously, it went really well. There was a really funny tweet, though. It said, has Hitler got an album out because he's everywhere? You just couldn't get away from him. Also, you're very kind about not punching people in the face. There was a very nice piece in the Times. Did you see that letter? Apparently, one of your colleagues in the Tory party said, I don't want to stab David Cameron in the back. I want to do it in the front because I want to see the expression on his face. I then can take the knife back and use it on Osborne. And I thought, goodness me, this must be...
They know an awful lot about stabbing, don't they?
I think some of my colleagues have been watching Game of Thrones too much and it's absorbed the... atmosphere.
Obviously, there was talk about Hitler from Boris, and then Cameron said, well, it could lead to World War III. It's escalating all these things that could happen, and apparently they're worried that the turnout's only going to be 50%. So, obviously, the general public are fairly relaxed about the coming Armageddon, it seems.
Yeah. No, I think turnout will be high. Normally, people don't talk about politics to politicians, weirdly, if you just meet them sort of in the supermarket and things like that. And for weeks now, it's the only thing people have wanted to talk to me about in a constituency where they tend to recognise you. So my sticking my neck out prediction is that turnout will be much higher than people think.
But the level of hyperbole and paranoia, it's almost like a Daily Mail editorial at the moment. You're almost expecting somebody to go, well, you know, if we stay in the EU, it'll give you cancer. And then the next day, someone going, no, actually leaving the EU will give you cancer, and it will be the Daily Mail.
Well, the Daily Mail actually did that in that Ros Altman, who is pensions minister but has for years been one of Britain's biggest pension experts, made the point, if the economy goes downhill, as it will if we leave, then there'll be less money to go around. So pensions will actually be less good. And the following day, the Daily Mail headline was, your pensions will get worse if you stay in the EU. They just flatly reversed the truth of what she'd said. So, yes, I think the Daily Mail is playing an interesting and at times constructive role in this debate, but mostly it's just being the Daily Mail.
And... Well, Chris Grayling, he's been involved as well. He's another one of the Brexit people. This is the man who said when it came to the benefit welfare cap, didn't he? He said it wasn't going to lead to any cases of homelessness. He said, but it may lead to some individual cases of housing mobility. So I'm guessing that nobody's going to be poorer if we leave the EU. There'll just be some individual cases of maybe economic realignment.
That's right. Economic realignment involving people maybe losing such close touch with their job. I think that will happen, or would happen, if we voted to leave. And all those who say, you know, this is Britain strong and free, and there's this whole thing about, you know, you're not patriotic if you don't think Britain should tear yourself away from the EU... This is just garbage. I think the technical term is garbage, for the polite technical term, because I don't see how reducing the size of our economy, reducing our influence in the world, reducing the regard other countries holding us is in any way patriotic. So I will quite happily wrap myself in the flag in the face of people telling me, as anti-Europeans have done all my political life when I've been pro-European, one of the things you constantly get accused of is being a traitor. And I'm getting close to thinking I want to punch people in the face again now, so I should calm down at this point.
I'm going to go very carefully with the questions. It could all kick off otherwise. Andy and Anita, what are your thoughts?
I'm really interested about the turnout question, because I'm not sure what it's going to be. I do host a political phone-in programme every week, and it's been the topic that people have wanted to talk about, and not just talk about, but get very anxious about. I think both sides... ratcheting up the mutually assured destruction scenarios, making people really panicky. But what's really stunning about people calling up is that they keep saying, we don't know who to trust. They've got their figures, you've got your figures. And what's happening, the sum total, the zero game of this, is that they think everybody is a liar. So, and there is something really interesting with this, because it's called the impartiality paradox. So you go to somebody and you say, tell me what... you think, analyse this impartially, tell me what you think. This is a binary thing. You're either in or you're out. That's the way it's been set up. So the moment one of these organisations, be it the IMF or the Small Business Confederation or someone else, comes down on a side, immediately they say, well, you're being paid by the other side. The amount of distrust over this referendum, the lack of trust in politics, which is something that breaks my heart, I think has been accelerated of danger.
Nobody actually really knows, do they? It's all sort of conjecture. It's guesswork, basically. Nobody knows what will happen if we try and renegotiate, if we do leave, what will happen to jobs, what will happen to the economy. Isn't it going to basically come down, for a lot of people, a gut instinct? What do you think of Polish plumbers?
Well, a lot of it is, I mean, and it's right that, who do people trust? And it's interesting, inevitably, we've all, I'm sure both sides, have done the research on this. And weirdly, among the top two groups, one of the groups people trust are small businesses, not big business, but small businesses. The other one are economists, you know, famously a profession that can never agree on anything. But people out there will believe economists.
They may believe economists, but they don't necessarily believe the politicians when they're quoting the economists. That's part of the problem, isn't it?
That's right. And you know, we all accept that. So we're all scouring around to find economists who are on our side. And as Anita said, you know, on our side, we've got all the big economic organisations saying it would be very dangerous to leave, at which point the Leave side say, it's an establishment conspiracy. They're all in the pay, peculiarly, of the European Union.
It's certainly, it's definitely a top-heavy thing, isn't it? IMF, you know, all the trade unions, OECD, President of the United States of America, and then on the other side, you've basically got Boris Johnson, John Redwood, Chris Grayling, and Nigel Farage. It doesn't seem quite equivalent, does it?
It may be the case that if most people agree on a proposition, it's because the proposition is true. Most people believe that 2 + 2 = 4, and that's not an establishment conspiracy, it's just true.
But what this tells you, the reaction of people, and the venomous reaction of people to this, and this frequent thing of it's a conspiracy, they would say that, wouldn't they? Do you know how much money they get? what's going to happen on the other side of this referendum is what worries me, which is the debasement of our political system and our democracy, where there is no trust. If we're not going to trust anybody, what are we going to be left with? And that's what I worry about, and I don't know what we're going to have.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see if it does change our political landscape. There's been a lot of talk about political accountability in Europe, and yet we have an electoral system that leads to huge skewings of the public vote in terms of representation in Parliament. I don't know if there'll be some knock-on of people going back to that as an issue. I'd hope so. In terms of the facts, there are actually, in the internet age, more facts in the world than there have ever been before, and that's just one of them. Of those facts now, I believe 96% of facts are now false. So it's really hard to find the 4% of facts that are at least partially true. And the ones that are partially true are often completely irrelevant. So it's really hard to know. And in terms of the economy, you know, there's contradictions. David Cameron saying it's going to be bad for the economy if we leave Europe, but at the same time saying it could lead to a world war. And, you know, world wars often actually good for many parts of the economy. So, you know, there's a contradiction that he's laying out there. He can't have it both ways.
And another fact that you've thrown into the mix there.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a fact, it's a guess. But you know, if you say, I think what we've seen over and again through politics is that if you repeat a guess often enough, it becomes a fact. It transmutes into a fact.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
We talk about trust in politics. The BBC, you are chairman of the all-party BBC group, and the charter renewal came out a couple of weeks ago. And then a week later, BBC Recipes was going to go down. 200,000 people furious with this. We were losing BBC Recipes. And that was, you know, people... I mean, it takes a lot to get British people riled up, but taking down Recipes or... George Osborne, he said, didn't he? He said, it's a public broadcaster, not an online newspaper. Well, they are a broadcaster, and the public want them to publish recipes, because people like the BBC recipes, don't they? Because they don't have any adverts on them, and you get the ingredient and the method on the same page, rather than scrolling down, suddenly some advert's starting, you're not quite sure where it is, you're trying to click on it to stop it, then you click on it, it takes you through to the bloody advert, then you try and go back, you can't go back. By that stage, you're so hungry, you've got to phone for a freaking takeaway. You weren't sure what I was talking about.
I've never looked at a recipe page in my life, so I'm impressed by your dedication.
But there was a lot of people.
But what was funny about it was that the week before the white paper came out, the BAFTAs was full of people also predicting World War III and the end of the world, and all our favourite lovies were up there saying, you know, this government was going to eviscerate the BBC and it was going to kill it, and it didn't. And there was this sort of cartoon character, just run over the edge of the cliff and didn't look down, and then they plummeted. But they've carried on as though.
But there is a serious point here, though, because the board is changing. It's not the BBC Trust. So there is going to be a unitary board. Now, there's a big disagreement within the BBC as to who's actually going to be on that board. The BBC wanting it to be an independent board. John Whittingdale, very keen for at least half the appointments to be sort of government appointments. And what you want an independent BBC. You don't want people that John Whittingdale has met on Tinder suddenly governing the BBC.
You want diversity on the BBC board. There are many ways of achieving it. The majority of that board need to be not appointed by the government, and that's where it's ended up.
This is a disagreement you have with certain factions of your own party.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Yeah. If I wanted to make myself unpopular in my own party, then deciding at the same time to defend the EU and the BBC is a good way to go about it. I can tell you,
people were saying Britain was basically individualism plus NHS, and you could add to that plus BBC plus recipes. We don't have much, do we, that in Britain that is number one, but at the moment, apparently, we are the soft power, the largest soft power in the world due to our cultural exports.
And recipes.
Thanks to Mary Berry, they are now making lemon drizzled tray bake in Papua New Guinea.
Yeah.
It is a vision for Britain, isn't it? And make cakes, not war.
I'm wondering why they don't freeze properly. But it's true. Now, the BBC is absolutely one of our great national institutions, and it's absolutely something that doesn't work in theory but does work in practice. If you were faced with the modern broadcasting landscape and you said, what we're going to do is charge a poll tax to everyone in the country and we'll give it to a big organisation and tell them to go away and make TV and radio programmes and online stuff and recipes and whatever, you'd think that's the worst idea I've ever heard. But actually, that's what we do. And it produces the best broadcasting in the world. It is one of the things we're best at, which is why I wanted to defend the BBC. But I mean, when we end up arguing about the weight of independent and non-independent directors on the board, it shows how far the debates move, because people were thinking they'd abolish the licence fee, or they'd stop the BBC doing popular, they'd take Strictly off the air and ban the Archers and things like that. Now,
Radio 4's Any Answers was going to go.
Yeah, that would be the end of the middle classes. No government.
But the end of times, wouldn't it?
There's no answers left.
Isn't it the case that if one of the things that sets off Britain's nuclear deterrent is if the captain of the Trident submarine can't get Radio 4 for a period of time, then it's clear that Armageddon has started. So he may as well fire the missiles.
Yeah. So
that's true. Radio 4. If you have dead time, I work for Radio 4, about 3 minutes of dead time, then that is a green light. And so if things go down, because machines break all the time at the BBC, it's all held together by your good wishes and spit. But if things do go dead, they have birdsong that comes on just so that there's something playing, that you have emergency tapes or repeated trails. Really? Just
how long has
no
this been
silence.
The case?
Ever since it went wrong and they let off a nuclear weapon.
Right. I don't know, but for
was
a very
the Cuban
long time,
missile
because
crisis?
some of these voices that are on the loop tape, which I've heard on standby, are very clipped and old. So yeah,
because cricket's been on Radio 4 for a long time, and there's quite a lot of times when nothing happens for 3 minutes.
Could do with some birdsong, couldn't they?
Aggers, you've just set off a nuclear war.
Well, let's move on to you, Anita. You've been a signatory for trying to get a suffragette statue in Parliament Square, and some success this week. Sadiq Khan has said that, yes, he would very much like to see a suffragette statue in Parliament Square, subject to planning permission. Great news that the London mayor still needs to get planning permission for such things. I was unaware. But you would think they would be able to do that. 11 statues are there currently. Not easy to say, we can't have a 12th. This will look out of place, would have thought.
And they're all men. I mean, they're all statues of statesmen. And the reason I was getting sort of anxious, and still am anxious about what happens after the referendum and who do people trust and whether they engage with the political process. I was apoplectically angry at the beardy weirdy Russell Brand, who said don't bother to vote at the last election. I think that was damaging, dangerous and irresponsible. I think if you don't like who's on the ballot sheet, go spoil your paper. Do something, but don't lose the voice that you have. because for a long time I've been researching the suffragette movement, and it wasn't that long ago where half of you didn't get a say because you have ovaries, which apparently made you slightly berserk and unable to make any kind of decision. So, I mean, I sort of, that's not very long ago.
But, I mean, if we relate this back to the EU, obviously the great thing about a referendum is that your vote will count. Part of the reason Russell Brand was saying don't vote was it, you know, in some constituencies it wouldn't count. But obviously referendum, every vote will count. So young people apparently, you know, vote 3-1 to stay in, but a lot of them aren't registered. So what we thought we'd do for this Slacktivist Action Group, rather than they're doing phone a granny, aren't they? Part of the stronger in, phone your granny, tell her to vote in. Rather than that, phone a young person and tell them to get registered by June the 7th. Preferably a young person you know, yeah? Otherwise, but it, you know, it is important, isn't it, that people do get registered.
Yeah, because if you drop off the radar, if you don't vote, I mean, even if it's in a general election, even if it's in a safe constituency, I firmly believe if you don't register, you don't matter. If you don't register even a protest, you don't matter. Politicians, and please forgive me for saying this, they love it when people drop off the radar if they don't agree with whoever is standing. It makes life easier. You don't have to worry about those people.
But maybe it's not so much loving it, it's how you respond. Because I say this to sixth form groups. All politicians talk to sixth formers a lot. And they say to me, why do politicians not listen to young people? And like many politicians, I soft soap them for years. Now I don't anymore. I just say, it's because you don't vote. Mm. There are fewer of you than there are of the over 60s. The over 60s, 2/3 of them vote. 1/3 of you vote. If you were me, who would you listen to? At which point, they all get it, and I hope they go and register to vote.
But surely, at which point, if we're encouraging young people to vote, age 16, we should reduce it down to age 16. At the moment, age 16, you can get married, you can fight for your country, and you can buy liqueur chocolates. But you can't...
Which should be banned, for everybody.
But you can't vote. The thing is, if you muck up your vote, all you've got is a spoilt ballot paper. If you muck up marrying, fighting for your country, or buying liqueur chocolates, you're either going to find yourself divorced, dead, or extremely, extremely fat and very angry that you're not at all pissed.
Also, with the Europe referendum, I think it's very important for young people to vote. It's a decision that's going to reverberate for 100 years in this country. I think there's a strong argument to be made that everyone from the age of 0 to 18 should get 2 votes in this referendum, and no one over the age of 60 should be allowed to vote, because the impact of it is going to be... In fact, unborn people should be allowed to vote. They should come up with some system where sperms and eggs get some kind of proportional vote. I don't know how the science would work on that, because this is a decision for, you know, 2 generations down the line.
I mean, they were saying that the older generation much more likely to vote leave, and the younger generation much more likely to vote in. So you're thinking, well, whose future is it? If young people aren't going to vote, the very least they could do is make a racket outside an old person's house on ballot day, so as they're too frightened to come out of their own home, at least even things up that way.
There's not enough intimidation in British democracy.
But these statutes, you're right, there's only...
Yeah, I mean, there's one of it. If you go to Parliament, there is a little park on the right-hand side of, you know, past Big Ben, keep going right, you go past the Piers entrance, there's Victoria Gardens, and inside there's a statue of Emmeline Pankhurst. I used to eat my sandwiches there every day when I did a programme called The Daily Politics, and she's sort of... It's quite emotional, actually. She's got her hand pointed towards Parliament because she's shown women the way, but she's out of Parliament. And the reason why I think, and other women who've signed this... petition asking the mayor to change that, is that this is wrong, is that Parliament Square, and really not very long ago, because there are living links for this book that I wrote, there are people yet living who knew the suffragettes who fought for that right. When I say fought, it is a fist-to-face fight that took place on a day called Black Friday. Winston Churchill was the Home Secretary. He'd asked his police not to make arrests that day. He wanted to tire out the suffragettes, send them back, so that they just stop bothering him and clogging up the prisons with their pesky hunger striking. And then he'd have to force feed them, and it was all all inconvenient. And they wouldn't go away. They absolutely refused to back off. So a 5.5-hour battle took place in Parliament, on the street where you can walk, where police mounted with truncheons beat these women, threw them against the concrete, and use sexual violence. I mean, we've seen what has happened fairly recently in places like Tahrir Square. That happened in our own, before, in the shadow of the mother of democracy, the daughters of this country were brutally sexually assaulted in the name of keeping the status quo. Now, I think that deserves a little more than just a nod in a history book that somebody won't read. I think to see one of, and I don't care who it is, there are amazing women who fought for the right of us to vote. So I think it would just be proper and right and about time to have one of those suffragettes recognised.
Yeah, and at the moment, the 11 statues, as you say, all men, seven prime ministers, then there's Gandhi, Nelson Mandela, Abraham Lincoln, and Jan Smuts. Mm. Now, yeah. I don't think Jan Smuts is going to be massively missed if they won't give you extra playing permission. Jan Smuts is essentially there because he was a mate of Churchill's, wasn't he? He is the Churchill's equivalent of Barry down the pub, essentially.
Well, I mean, a South African statesman who believed very much in apartheid and who believed very much it's a very interesting thing that Jan Smuts is quite close to Gandhi. There's a lovely story about them. So Gandhi started his political career in South Africa. He was a barrister and he couldn't practice. He was thrown off a train. It was kind of a Rosa Parks moment for him. And he decided that this just could not stand and became politicised and kept getting arrested. So he'd stir up the Indians in South Africa, particularly in the Transvaal, to rip up their identity papers. Jan Smuts was in charge at this time and tearing his hair out from the roots because he kept throwing this man in prison. He kept getting arrested. He kept throwing him in prison. Very much the suffragette kind of model, in fact, which Gandhi, in fact, replicated, learned from. But Jan Smuts finally gets rid of Gandhi because Gandhi discovers there's a bigger fight to fight in India, the land of cricket, which I'm really interested to hear. Such changes in that country. And when he left, the day he left, Gandhi gave Jan Smuts a pair of sandals that he'd made himself. And Smuts just didn't understand, what the hell is this? But thank God you're going, goodbye. And I think it was 50 years later, returned the sandals to Gandhi on his 70th birthday and said, I have worn these for many years. I am not fit to stand in the shoes of the man who gave them to me. So, I mean, that's a really lovely story. I'd love statues to live a bit more, you know, where they are.
You don't get that when you read the plaque at the bottom.
No, you don't.
Not.
No, you don't. So I'm not in favour. You know, there's this whole campaign of removing troublesome people. Don't remove them. Just put the stories around. I think it's much more informative.
Well, I didn't really
put some nice shoes on him.
Oh, some sandals, yes. Some sandals.
Your reason you got into it was you've written a fantastic book so far... Basically, as I understand it, you saw a picture of a suffragette outside Hampton Court selling newspapers, and you thought she looked a little bit Indian, and you thought, there's a story that I've not heard about.
Yeah.
I will research this. And then you thought, well, I found out, Sophia Duleep Singh, I shall write the book.
Yeah,
people need to know about
this.
Yeah,
I mean, she was just an extraordinary life. And, you know, we're bad at writing people of colour's history, but we are really bad at writing women's history too. So here's someone who's both of those things. In a nutshell, the daughter of a Maharaja who owned the Koh i Noor diamond, goddaughter of Queen Victoria, socialite, kind of the Kate Middleton of her day, champion dog breeder, who was a pointless, vacuous oaf of a woman until she discovered politics and became this sort of militant suffragette. And I didn't want to write this book, it's such hard work. But actually, when I found this picture, which you've heard of Gaydar, we have a thing, I'm Punjabi ethnically, we have Punjar, which is like from Google Earth, you recognise one of your own. And it was this picture that just didn't make sense to me. I thought, you know, I'm a political journalist, how do I not know about this Indian suffragette? And I looked for a book, and the fact that there wasn't one, and the fact that it took me 4 years to piece together this amazing story of this extraordinary woman...
It was amazing, wasn't it? Because she was there, she was a goddaughter of Queen Victoria, she's an Indian princess, and she's essentially outside Hampton Court selling suffragette newspapers, the equivalent of basically going, you know, Standard!
Yeah,
Standard!
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I mean, more than, you know, the Black Friday demonstration, the riot that I told you about, she led that march with Emmeline Pankhurst. She was one of the first to get her face punched in by a police officer. She wrote these letters of complaint because she was such an aristocrat and somebody, you know, she was one of these... women's magazines had just started coming out in 1911. And she was always in the pages, you know, because she was this very fashionable woman. And suddenly, in this riot, there's a police officer who has hold of a suffragette and keeps slamming her on the pavement. And suddenly, the most famous woman in England pops up and shoves him back into the wall, saying, unhand her. And so this is, you know, this is not just somebody who did the safe stuff, But somebody who did the dangerous stuff all the time.
She was also one of the first women in England to ride a bicycle.
Yes, she was.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, not,
absolutely.
Not considered very ladylike riding a bicycle. Obviously not easy to do it side saddle. So, you know, 2 feet trying to go for the same pedal.
Well, they even invented a saddle for ladies. When they realised that these ladies were going to, no matter what anyone said, range freely and sweatily across the green and pleasant lands of England, and it was bad, you know, that they would go out unchaperoned. It really affronted people at the time. But when women just carried on doing it, and Sophia, one of the first to ride a bicycle in public, they invented a saddle with a hole in the middle, because one that didn't have a hole would unnecessarily excite a woman and perhaps drive her mad. And so these very odd... you can still find them, these sort of, like, very strange contraptions with a hole in the middle for your lady bits, existed. But, you know, that was actually... It was one of the first sort of blows for feminist freedom.
It's a very weird mental image that I've now got.
Sorry about that, yeah. But it was striking a blow for, like, you know, actually... moving on your own without a chaperone, to be able to go where you want to go, to be physically fit and active. So the bicycle was a real feminist statement.
So Andy, you obviously mentioned cricket earlier. You're a fan of the sport. We have a festival of sport coming up, so we thought it might be a bit of fun to look at some political odds, what the current betting is.
Yes.
You may have seen that EU at the moment, you can get 4-1 on us leaving the EU. Now, for a two-horse race, that's pretty amazing odds, isn't it?
Yeah,
if it was actually a horse race, you would think that the jockey had a severe thyroid problem or something else going on.
Yes, well, I guess in the age of Leicester City's 5,000-1 shot league title, when 4-1 is basically you've already won it these days. So... we're pretty much out of Europe already, as far as I can tell. I'm more interested in the accumulator bets, whether you can put on, you know, when you bet on more than one event. So if you can put a bet on Britain leaving the EU and David Cameron's prophecy of a Third World War breaking out coming true, I don't know what the odds on that would be, maybe 15-1. Donald Trump becoming president, he's currently about 2-1, I think.
2-1, which, again, for a two-horse race is, you know, it's not a bad bet.
Yeah.
Obviously a terrible outcome, but not a bad bet.
Yes, but just the fact that Donald Trump is 2-1 to become American president is something that should chill the entire planet to its core. How has this happened? I mean, he should be, at best, 2,000-1, and something has gone very, very wrong. But if you put the accumulator, Trump to become president and the world to end within 10 years, I reckon that's only about 2 and a bit to 1.
Are you excited by a chance of a first female American president?
I'm sort of just worried by the 2-1 odds of Donald Trump.
You think of going online straight away, Bet365.
it's just not worth it. I'd rather just hold my head in my hands until it's all over. I've been speaking to so many Americans who just keep telling me this is not who we are.
I do think with Trump, though, that clearly what's happened is Donald Trump and Boris Johnson were twins, separated at birth. They were born in a secret Soviet facility. On the exact same day, somewhere in the wilds of Siberia. And they smuggled, they split them at birth, and they put one into the American capitalist system and one into British private education. And with the exact same genetic makeup, those are the endpoints of those two institutions. So it's one of the most fascinating scientific experiments that's ever happened. It'll come out one day. It's covered by the Official Secrets Act currently, but it will come out.
OK, well, let's move that on. I mean... In terms of Boris Johnson, he is. I mean, you're thinking, given that he was born in America, he is eligible, isn't he, to become the American president, which obviously, given that he wants to be the British Prime Minister, I think would be preferable if he decided to become the American president. But we can look at now the odds for the Labour leadership if Jeremy Corbyn leaves. At the moment, we have Lisa Nandy on 6-1. We have, top of the list, Dan Jarvis, 5-1, and Ed Balls is on 66-1.
And I think Gordon Brown was 200-1, when I checked, which would, that's 25 times more likely than Leicester City winning the Premier League. So,
well, Ed Balls is quite surprising at 66-1, given that he's not actually an MP at the moment, is he? But then, I suppose, you know, Gordon Brown not either. And I did actually look for the Conservative leadership. Would you be at all interested in this, Damien?
No. I don't think it's any relevance at all to anything.
3-1 on Boris at the moment, 5-1 on George Osborne. And Damien, you're in there. You're in the betting. 100-1 at the moment.
That means I'm, was it 20 times more likely than Leicester City?
50 times.
50 times more likely than Leicester City. I wouldn't waste your money.
No. You're in there with Louise Mensch and Liz Kendall, who's a Labour MP. Yeah, so
Louise Mensch, who lives in America and isn't an MP.
That's right. But at 200-1, giving it 200-1, John Bercow, the Speaker, at the moment. We also have Andrew Strauss, ex-cricket captain. And Nigel Farage, leader of the Conservative Party. So,
yeah, I mean, that does highlight quite how extraordinary the Leicester City title triumph was. Yeah, Nigel Farage is 25 times more likely to become Tory leader than they were to win the title. So extraordinary times we live in. But yeah, I think there's something to be said for emotional cover betting on politics as well. So if you're really... if you're American and you're, you know, strongly opposed to Donald Trump, you basically put everything you own on Donald Trump becoming president. Then if he doesn't, you don't mind. You'll piece your life back together under the safe, more safe Clinton regime. If he does become president, you get a massive compensation payout, essentially. So this is the way you should all bet. You should basically, it's emotional insurance. That's how political gambling should work.
I'd rather lose the money than... looking forward, though, to having Hillary Clinton as the next Prime Minister, or not Prime Minister, obviously, President. It was probably the technical description I was after. But, yeah, if only because it obviously means that Bill Clinton is going to have to become the First Lady. And he'll be a danger to himself, won't he? So, so we've just got time. Let's move on to a chance for a few questions, Jason. Before we get... It's keen down the front. Before we do that, whilst other people are thinking about what to do, I should just tell you who's here for the next Slacktivist Action Group. We have David Davis. It's going to be after the EU referendum. So we'll have David Davis here, ladies and gentlemen. We will also have Sarah Pascoe, brilliant stand-up Sarah Pascoe. And we will have also Dan Hodges, Telegraph columnist, will be here. So please come along. It's going to be on, I believe it's the 27th, last Monday of the month, 27th. If you want to check out who else is going to be coming up, we have Andrew Mitchell in July, Andrew Mitchell MP. We also have Chris Addison will be coming along for that one. And as well as that, we have Liz Hutchins from Friends of the Earth. So get along. If you've got any questions, please go on the website and you can ask them. We also had last time, in fact, we had somebody on from Amnesty and they left a T-shirt behind. So best question for next month, there'll be a free T-shirt. It is, I'll just get it up. Here we go. It says, there we go, Save the Human Rights Act. I would ask Damien to model it, but I'm not sure he would oblige, ladies and gentlemen. So,
No, I would.
Oh, you would? There we go.
Also, you can have a quiz question associated with it. Oh. Which member of the current cabinet was president of the Amnesty Group at university? And if you can get it in three, then you deserve a lot of T-shirts.
OK, there we go. So there's a question, and if anybody who gets that and asks a question of the panel for next month, that'd be great. So, hands up, who has got a question for our panel? We have one down the front.
Can you explain why, if leaving the EU is going to be such a catastrophic event for the UK, that a responsible government and a prime minister would actually approve a referendum in the first place?
Because people would... demanding it. There was an enormous public pressure for it. It's been 40 years since we had the last referendum, and yeah, hopefully this will settle it for another 40 years. You know, it's all our job, those of us who believe that it would be disastrous to leave, to make sure that we win this referendum. But the longer you kept denying people a referendum, the more you're sort of pushing the plug back in the bottle, the bigger the explosion at the end. And if people, you know, Anita's talked rightly about sort of distrust of politicians. If you appear to say, we know there's this enormous pressure for a referendum because because of the way the parties, like the parliamentary system, can't cope with this very binary decision, then the sooner you allow it, to some extent, the better, rather than just let people get disillusioned over a decade or so, saying they're not giving us a proper choice.
I could sense there Damien was getting slightly tetchy right at the top of that one, wasn't he? It was almost like he was somebody who was going to say he was going to punch somebody, ladies and gentlemen. What other questions? Anybody else got a question?
Just to follow that up, do you think it actually will resolve the question? Haven't the Brexiters already lined up their arguments for when they lose, and the argument will just continue?
I mean, the argument will continue, but I think once you've taken a decision, you've taken a decision. I detect little public appetite for returning to this year after year. This is not going to be like the Eurovision Song Contest. I think once we've done it once, we won't want to do it again for a very long time.
I felt that about the Eurovision Song Contest the first time. I also think that's one of the reasons why I think the vote will be to remain, because I think leaving would be a much bigger step. That sort of, you can't check once it's done, that is a massive upheaval that you can't go back on. If people are wavering to stay in some way, it might be just putting it off for another generation or another 30-40 years. So I think we generally don't vote for massive change in this country, I think.
No, but if Scotland's anything to go by, in 2 years' time, it'll be all happening again, won't it? I don't think it will have quelled it, will be my personal thing, my guessing, especially if Boris becomes Prime Minister at 3-1.
But, I mean, there is another theory as to why the Prime Minister went down this route, and it was, if you remember the last general election, and, I was covering a constituency count at that time, all of the pointy-headed people said that it was going to be so close. They spent 2 months talking about coalitions. Nobody believed there would be an outright majority, and that includes the Prime Minister. He did not think. And the promise was, if we get an outright majority, we will give you a referendum. So there is a school of thought that says, actually, he never thought he was going to get it or have to do it.
So there we go. We can blame the Lib Dems, ladies and gentlemen. If only they'd got more seats, it would have worked out differently. We will wrap up proceedings. Thank you very much for coming this evening. Obviously, for those people who are listening on the podcast, if you could please subscribe, spread the word. If a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing, we are lethal with the Slacktivist Action Group, ladies and gentlemen. So please thank all of our guests. I think we have learnt some things tonight. We have learnt that, don't go up to Damien and say, I'm a racialist, but we've learnt that. Obviously, with Anita, please support the fact that we're going to be, hopefully, Sadiq Khan will find a place for a suffragette statue in Parliament Square. And from Andy, obviously, it's very much been down to cricket. We have learnt that world wars could have been caused, less often if people played more cricket. And if you are ever in a taxi in New York, careful of the taxi drivers. Most of them have a cricket bat in the boot. Andy, you wanted to come in there quickly.
On that subject,
I was trying to wrap things up beautifully.
I saw that. But you mentioned cricket helping avoid world wars. The great early 20th century English cricketer C.B. Fry, there's a story that he went to Germany in the 1930s and spoke to von Ribbentrop and tried to persuade him that German youth should take up cricket as a means of physical recreation. And the Nazis spurned that offer, and a few years later, World War II broke out. But, if he'd been successful, unquestionably everything would have been fine.
On that note, ladies and gentlemen, please give a big hand for our guests this week, Damien Green MP, Anita Anand, and Andy Zaltzman. Thank you very much. Good luck.